here's a question for you. Should kids get the jab? Children under 19 make up more than a third of our population. Can we have any conversation then about immunity from COVID-19 without them? Is it a good idea to use them in vaccine trials? The National Institute for Communicable Diseases has released its numbers on COVID-19 and young people under the age of 19 and found that the number of children and adolescents tested, diagnosed and admitted increased during the third wave to the peak period. But there were no increases in fatalities or ICU admissions compared to adults. To help us wade through all of this is a senior epidemiologist at the NICD, Dr. Tendasai Kufa Chakeza, who joins us now on the line. A very good morning to you, Doctor. Thank you so much for your time.
Good morning, Mongani. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm very well. I hope you are too. Let's talk about this report looking at the NICD's surveillance, particularly when it comes to younger people younger than the age of 19. We're seeing some trends during the third wave, at least, that we hadn't seen in the first two waves of COVID-19.
Yes, that's correct. We are seeing, we saw a lot more young people being tested for COVID, a lot more young people testing positive, slightly more young people being admitted, but no change in deaths, like what you said earlier.
I mean, one of the difficulties around this, of course, is that for individuals under the age of 19, they tend to be asymptomatic, or if they have any symptoms, those tend to be mild, and therefore perhaps a lot more people would have been infected with COVID-19 than we even realize.
That's correct. But it may also be go the other way, that we found more cases because we tested more children, because the main difference between the first, second, and the third wave is that in the third wave, schools were open most of the time. You remember we closed them when alert level 3 was implemented, I think, at the end of June, and then we opened at the end of July, 4 weeks later. But for the most part of the third wave, the schools were open. So we also think that that contributed in the sense that when there's a child with COVID, we then test the friends and the classmates or, you know, other people that are in contact with the child. Whereas in the first and the second wave, children were at home, so they were probably relatively protected and maybe not testing as much. But I do agree with you that we may also be underestimating the number of children that that had COVID in this time.
But also your report points out that there doesn't seem to be a correlation between the number of cases amongst youngsters and the timing of the opening or closing of schools. That's not a major driver of the waves.
Yes, but we're talking about in terms of just testing. So how many we pick up and when we pick them up wasn't related to the opening and the closing of schools. But we think that because schools were open, we may have tested more children, simply because if there's a case, we then, you know, do that testing of the contacts as required by the basic education protocol.
One of the things, of course, around the reporting of this is that children typically do not suffer severe symptoms. But we do have the case of a couple in KwaZulu-Natal, parents who claim that two of their children did die from COVID-19, although, of course, that has not been confirmed yet by medical experts.
Yes, so we have, in that report that you're looking at, we have about 560 deaths. I don't have the actual number at the top of my head, that have been associated with COVID. And the difficulty is that, you know, a child is in hospital and a child is COVID positive and they died. Those are the things that we can confirm. They may or may not have had other conditions, underlying conditions or other medical conditions, which may well have contributed to their death, but we know that they had COVID when they died. Whether they died from COVID or whatever else brought them to hospital, because we know that also when children go to hospital, like any other person, before they're admitted, they get tested for COVID. So,
right.
That becomes a problem,
right?
Because we don't do postmortems all the time, and the medical doctors sometimes are not able to distinguish because we go by what the attending clinician says. So is it possible that this child may have died from COVID? and if they cannot rule that out. So the sort of deaths that are ruled non-COVID related would be, say, a child is in hospital, they came in with a road traffic, you know, trauma from a road traffic accident, and we test them at entry and they are COVID positive. But we know that no one brought them in hospital. You know, and they died maybe as a result of their head injury or whatever else that brought them to hospital in the first place. But we know that children with underlying conditions, diabetes, HIV, heart disease, cancers, all of those, they're much more likely to die. They're overrepresented among the children that died for whom we have data on.
I suppose it raises the question then that even though children are not as likely to die from COVID-19 as are adults, it raises the question, what should the position be as far as vaccinating children, and how soon do you think we should be thinking about it?
So as you know, we are already thinking about it. We had a trial of the Sinovac vaccine that started already here in South Africa last week, looking at children between the age of 6 months and 17 years that are not eligible for vaccination at the moment. And we had Pfizer being granted emergency use authorization by SAHPRA to give vaccines to 12 to 17-year-old or 12 to 18-year-old who, up until last week when that emergency authorization came through, were also not eligible for vaccination. So people have been thinking about it, particularly the older teens, because you see in that report, if our listeners have time to go look at it, that, you know, our cases increased quite a lot in the 15 to 19-year-old age groups, and as well as the 10 to the 14-year-old. So people are thinking that, you know, and we know that this age group is likely to transmit almost as much as adults. And so that's a incentive for us to vaccinate that group for the benefit of reducing transmission. But we know that these vaccines are not 100% effective in reducing transmission either, but they do reduce it substantially. Data that's coming out is transmission is reduced, or getting COVID, whether it's serious or not, any COVID type you have, is about 50 to 90% depending on the vaccine that you got. So they are effective, but not 100%. So
sure,
that's the reason why we are considering. And also the children that have underlying conditions, as we have said.
So ultimately, we can't really think about population immunity as such and exclude a third of the population, which would be children under 19.
Yes. And I think also the conversation has moved on from herd immunity and population immunity. More and more people are talking about vaccinating people to protect them from severe disease, because, you know, as the variants come and go, we might get a variant that will not respond as well, or will be able to break through the immunity that you have acquired from vaccination and still be able to get COVID and transmit COVID. But what the vaccines have shown consistently, regardless of which vaccine, is that they all reduce severe disease and death. So adults are being vaccinated precisely for that reason, to reduce severe disease and death. Transmission is an added benefit.
Dr. Tendasai, sorry to come in there. I thought you were done. One of the things that has happened because of COVID-19, and I suppose the apparent speed with which all of this has moved, it's brought things that perhaps lay people would not necessarily think much about. You've mentioned the Sinovac biotech trials for children. The lay person can look at that and perhaps even feel a little bit of discomfort in terms of children being used in trials. Can you explain the ethics of that and why that is not problematic?
So the main reason is that children are not small adults. So we cannot take data that we've collected in adults and automatically assume that the situation will be the same for children. So that's the main reason. That you find that a lot of drugs, even when you buy over the counter, they'll tell you don't use in children under two. And the reason is that there's no data in that population because the trials never included children under the age of two. So if we want to use these vaccines in children at some point, we do need that data, because no one is going to authorize a drug for use in children without data or in children, confirming safety in children.
What happens? What happens if there are adverse effects in those children in those trials?
It's the same thing that happens when there are adverse effects in trials involving adults. So So parents will have to consent to their children. They are told it's fine. We know this is what the vaccines may cause. They may cause new things. We don't anticipate that the children will get seriously ill from the vaccine. We don't anticipate that they'll die from the vaccine, but we monitor them so long. And yes, it's a risk that people have to take. And mind you, these vaccines, by the time they get to children, they've been done in adults. Before they even get to people, they're used in animal studies. So people have some sense that it's, you know, there are no gross or serious side effects associated with the vaccine. But having said that, they do happen, and that's the reason why you did this trial, to make sure, even after the vaccines are approved and licensed for use in that population, you continue to monitor side effects. You know the clotting problem with the AstraZeneca. Now we're hearing about the inflammation of the heart problem with Pfizer in children coming out of North America and Europe. This is data that you only then get when you're given a lot of doses, because they are so rare. You're looking at 40 or 50 cases per million doses given. So until you're vaccinated that rate, you're unlikely to pick those signals up.
The study is going to enroll participants from South Africa, but also from Kenya, the Philippines, Chile, and Malaysia. Would it be unfair to look at that list with some suspicion and think, why only developing countries?
But China is already using those vaccines for their own children. They started in June, I think. They're using Sinovac and Sinopharm for children, I think it's from age 3 and above, if I'm not mistaken. So they're not just bringing them here without using them in their own population. And they use them because they'd also done trials on Chinese children. So, you know, I know it looks suspicious and all of that. And, you know, China doesn't have the best reputation in the developing world for doing right by us. But I think it's fair. And I think that SAPRA would not let them come if they were not convinced. And Sinovac is pre-qualified by WHO. It has emergency use approval by WHO. Not for children, because there's no vaccine that WHO has given emergency use authorization for children, because they think we shouldn't be vaccinating children for vaccine equity reasons. Not for safety, but just, you know, vaccine equity. That's
sure.
The countries that haven't even vaccinated adults, and now you're talking about vaccinating children. It doesn't seem fair to them that we are doing that. But it has emergency use authorization and been validated by WHO, the same kind of vaccine that's coming to us for children.
All right. How soon do you expect this to be a reality now, once all the trials are concluded? When do you think the first children under 19 will be vaccinated in South Africa?
I'm not sure. Hey, I'm really not sure. I don't want to hazard a guess, because I'm not sure about where the trials are. They've only just started enrolling. And how where we are relative to the other countries that are vaccinating as well. But
we still have some distance to go.
Yeah, it's probably earliest middle of next year, maybe, when we have accumulated at least 6 months to a year's worth of data.
Dr. Tendasai Kufa-Chakeja, thank you very much for your time. Senior epidemiologist at the National Institute for Communicable Diseases.